attitude. We are going to energize the country.
We need to wake up and smell the coffee.
The independence case is a powerful one.
Another future is possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be once again joined by Chris Clark, the author of The Dark Knight and The Puppet Master, and of a new paper published by Progressive Britain, Thinking in Straight Lines. The country's more progressive, so why is the left losing? Welcome back to the podcast, Chris.
Thanks a lot for having me back, Will.
It's great to have you back. The first question that I'd like to ask is, what made you decide to write this paper for Progressive Britain?
Well, it came about in several stages, really. But the key point was after the last round of local elections. We're obviously recording this podcast on the eve of the 2022 local elections. But in the a year ago, we had the Hartlepool by-election loss and a kind of a continuation of some of that polarisation that we'd seen over the past few years. Mm-hmm. And there was quite a bit of debate online about what was driving that polarisation. Yeah. So it started really with that question, why is the country becoming more politically polarised, if you like? Mm-hmm. We were discussing just before we a little bit earlier that there's many more seats with 20,000 majorities for Labour, but also 20,000 majorities for the Conservatives, for example. So the country is polarising in a political sense, but my general sense is that people, all parts of the country, are generally moving in a kind of left liberal direction, potentially at different speeds, potentially from different bases. But there isn't a story of people going in two different ways in terms of their values. That's my sense based on all the polling evidence I've seen and based on my anecdotal experiences as well. When you speak to people who are more sort of socially conservative or who are more kind of Tory leaning, it's not that there's massive, massive values differences. Yet there is this big polarisation difference. So I wanted to try and get to the bottom of that, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one of the things that I think is interesting that you touch upon in the introduction is when you use an anecdote from 2015 when you were in South Thanet, and you recall a conversation that you had with someone who was a potential Labour voter who was there at an event to see Ross Kemp, who was there canvassing for Labour, who was trying to get support for Labour in that election. And you say in that anecdote that you were trying to refer to an area as a poor area, but that you got sort of a bit scrambled in how you wanted to get it out. And in the end, you made a remark saying that it may or may not be less affluent than other areas. And you use that as an example of how politics, particularly the politics of many on the left, has become a lot less direct and attempted to qualify what is meant by particular words and particular statements. Do you think that this is something that has perhaps not just come about in years subsequent to the 2010 election because of perhaps a further shift leftwards for the Labour Party, but is also due to the rise of communication online? Because quite often when you're speaking to someone online about a particular topic, it's difficult often to be quite as direct as you like to be, because you know you have to sort of like make your point as unambiguous as possible for fear of someone either deliberately or undeliberately misinterpreting what you're saying.
That's a really interesting angle to it, actually. The anecdote you described was one in South Thanet where I was working as the comms officer, but I just remembered this conversation where I, rather than referring to the area being poorer, ended up sort of caveating and then caveating a second time until what I said didn't really make any sense. And and it really came from, and I partly put that anecdote in at the start of this essay because I wanted to, you know, to be clear that I'm not saying I've got some master, I'm not great at this either myself.
Yeah.
You do sometimes feel that the kind of the liberal left I sort of frightened to just talk directly sometimes, and I was guilty of that on this occasion that I mentioned. Whether that's down to online, the online debates is a different question, and I'm not completely sure how big a role online plays. I do think online amplifies the fear that, and generally actually not just online, not just social media, but the 24-hour news context, amplifies the fear that maybe progressive people have of not wanting to say something where they put their foot in it by being too direct. So whether that's the source of the problem, I'm not sure, but I think it exacerbates the problem, because my being a kind of sort of liberal left progressive sort of person, or liking to think of myself in that way, my part of my fear of saying this area was, it's a poorer area, which it was that I was kind of frightened of appearing to imply that its poverty was of its own making, or that was somehow, or that I was stigmatizing or talking the area down, which I think is a consideration that is quite a well-meaning consideration, you might say, but also completely created a barrier between myself and a voter at a community centre who probably would have had quite similar values to me on a lot of big questions. So, my answer to that would be online and the wider fear of being caught out that social media creates probably makes people who are what I call more systemic thinkers, more society's fault type thinkers, pussyfoot around subjects a little bit more than they otherwise might. But I don't think it's necessarily the root cause of the problem.
Yeah. And on that point, one of the things that is central to your argument in the essay is the distinction between direct and, as you said there, systemic reasoners, systemic thinkers in terms of arguments and logic. Could you just explain what you mean by this sort of distinction? Because I think it's a very interesting one that you use in the essay, but people might not necessarily understand without a sort of like a full explanation what you mean between the difference between direct and systemic reasoners and arguers.
Yeah, it's a concept described by the American psychologist, political psychologist and linguist George Lakoff, who's written quite interestingly about why people tend to come down on one side of the political divide or the other, why people end up being conservatives or liberals, to use the American terminology. And I'd kind of borrowed this particular, he writes about lots of other stuff. This is quite a small part of his argument, but his argument is that certainly in the modern post-culture war United States, the Republicans speak very much to direct reasoning, which is linguistically kind of A plus B equals C. Yeah. You do X, it has Y outcome, the result is Z. It's, you can see the series of causes and they're kind of linear, hence the title of my essay was Thinking in Straight Lines. So he describes that as one way of reasoning, and systemic thinking as another way of reasoning, which is which is much more used by the Democrat Party in the US, and which tends to say that things are the results of the broader social and societal context from which they emerge. The example he uses is the environment, which to a direct reasoner is it's not at all intuitive or obvious thing why driving your car would cause ice caps to melt on the other side of the road.
Yeah.
And he uses the example of Republican senators bringing snowballs into the, bringing snowballs out in front of media cameras and saying, it's snowing, how can we have global warming? That doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And that may be laughable in some sense to a systemic reasoner, but it's also quite intuitive. To believe in climate change, you need to accept a whole set of systemic, wider sequences and factors and a whole set of tendencies rather than dealing in absolutes. That, you know, there's a tendency that for a range of systemic factors, somebody growing up in deprivation will be more likely to be drawn into into crime, for example, and therefore you adopt more of a tough on the causes of crime approach than a tough on crime approach. But that's not necessarily, there's lots of exceptions to that rule. It's not, it doesn't deal in absolutes, and it's much harder to understand in a certain respect. So my kind of argument is that the realignment happening in British politics is increasingly between these sorts of quite direct A plus B equals C direct types of reasoning and much more systemic, structural, societal analyses put forward by the progressive left. And often there's quite deep non-sequiturs happening. A lot of culture war debates, I think, take place on the basis of non-sequiturs between those two understandings of things. And I tend to my argument in thinking in straight lines is that that difference is bigger difference than we perhaps appreciate, and that the actual values differences when it comes to the environment or when it comes to equalities or a whole range of issues aren't as pronounced as we might think, but it's more that kind of causation difference that is a big and understated factor.
Mm-hmm. And in the essay you argue that one of the people who is best at using direct reasoning is Boris Johnson in terms of some of the language that he uses and some of the metaphors and things like that. Do you think that the way that he uses language in some ways perhaps mirrors a kind of like simplicity in language that Margaret Thatcher had? Because I remember years and years ago, this is going back about, I think, 10 years or so, when Johnson was being interviewed by Jeremy Paxman, he used an example of the kind of language that Margaret Thatcher used, that it was very sort of simple, direct language to get her point across. And he held that up as an example that he felt that other politicians should follow in terms of conveying points. Do you think that that's the kind of the key to him being able to resonate with people in following that same sort of technique that Margaret Thatcher had in terms of making her point very, very clear, like the ladies not for turning being perhaps one of the most famous examples of her use of language in that sense?
That's a really interesting point. I should be clear, when I use direct language, I'm not simply direct logic. I'm not simply talking about kind of short sentences necessarily, but about the wider kind of sequences and causes of effect that might happen. So you can get, I think, short sentences, a slogan like defund the police used by the contemporary activist left, which is, you know, three words, very simple on the face of it, might sound quite direct, but actually isn't necessarily intuitive to direct reasoner, because it relies on a whole set of systemic assumptions about the role of the police and whether tough policing is actually the way to deal with crime, or whether the wider societal problems are the thing that you need to deal with. On the question of Boris Johnson, absolutely, I think he is an extremely good at speaking to direct reasoners, and at doing so in a way that in a certain respect delivers real agency, and which demystifies, or which appears to demystify, quite complicated issues. So his use of metaphors, which we sometimes scoff at on the left, but when he talks about bunging Brexit in the microwave or things like that, he implies that something that was actually very complicated and systemic, i.e. removing a trading block of 27 countries, is as simple as making a four-minute ready meal for yourself. Yeah. And that is, on one level, that's very irresponsible, and I have a very low opinion of Boris Johnson, because I think he's highly responsible in the way he does some of these things and the way that he... But we also need... And that use of metaphors is an interesting parallel with Margaret Thatcher, you know, when she would talk about the national finances, very much using the narratives of the housewife looking at what's in the cupboard in the kitchen, sort of a thing, bringing complicated issues and implying that they follow the same logic as much more simple, direct A plus B equals C things. Mm. So I think that that parallel is definitely there with Boris Johnson. And I think he's able to be, to appeal to a raft of voters who do not consider themselves, are not drawn to the racism of Nigel Farage necessarily, aren't conventional Tories often in terms of what they support, and are not, would often even consider themselves relatively socially liberal and progressive in terms of their basic views about gender equality, things like this, but who are drawn to his willingness to kind of call a spade, to dismiss complex ideas as hogwash or guff or bunk or whatever. And even though he's using public school language to dismiss those terms, he's essentially saying, you don't need to worry. The world isn't as complicated and frightening as all that. Not every question is as complicated as it, as the left likes to make out. Sometimes it really is, does what it says on the tin. And I think that is an important thing to understand about his appeal and the agency that his appeal brings, even though he's obviously his star is very much fallen since Partygate. I think it's worth us taking some pause to think about why he's been so successful for a prolonged period at picking up those former Labour heartland voters. And I think his use of direct reasoning is a really big part of that.
Mm. One of the things that is also really interesting to pick up from the essay is the contrast, as you say, that Britain is becoming a more progressive country generally over time. And we're seeing that in the way that the Conservative Party reacts to progress. You use the example of David Cameron using language that's much more socially liberal than his predecessors, and Boris Johnson being in terms of economic policies to the left of some other previous Conservative leaders. Do you think then that this is something that perhaps is a way in which the Conservative Party can continue to renew itself? Because in the past decade and a bit, in the past 12 or 13 years that we've had a Conservative government, we've seen three Conservative prime ministers. And in each instance, we have seen a certain renewal once they have become leader of the party. Cameron obviously talking about things in a much more socially progressive or socially liberal way, then Theresa May talking about the just about managing, and then Boris Johnson, you know, saying that, oh, there isn't going to be any austerity and we have to invest more, we have to level up. Do you think that that's a core part of the way that the Conservatives are able to continue to appeal to certain voters, is that every so often, every couple of years, they almost have like a year zero moment where the party, at least aesthetically speaking and in terms of rhetoric, changes to make itself distinct from the previous Conservative Party of a few years before?
Yes, absolutely. And I think you're seeing that now with some of their behaviour. You know, I hope that these strategies won't be successful, by the way, obviously, but think things like the war on woke, the using the essential tactic that they've concluded works quite well in a country, which is that every part of society becoming steadily more socially liberal, is to pick wedge issues that divide the very liberal voters who are concentrated in cities and tend to be graduates from the quite liberal voters in the rest of the country. And the war on woke is a classic example of that, because it's picking up on things that the former would be comfortable with and the latter wouldn't. And Brexit actually was a good example. A lot of people, I think, who voted for Brexit weren't voting for a really kind of right-wing, socially conservative vision of Britain, but they were voting for a kind of simpler version, and I don't think it was as direct, as clearly a massive values divide as people sometimes think. So I think that they've decided that that's a successful strategy. And you're completely right. It would be basically unsayable to say even some of the things that were being said by Conservative politicians in the 1980s or early 1990s, not just on social issues, actually, but even I think the kind of on your bike rhetoric of Norman Tebbit, I don't think would play very well with anyone or with large numbers of people now, because those really, really right-wing economic arguments, I think, have also been dismissed in quite large part. So the fact that I think a big part of what's changed is that you can have a phenomenon where all parts of the country are moving in a more socially liberal, more socially progressive direction, whilst at the same time, the gap between those who are most socially liberal and those who are least socially liberal is growing because of increasing levels of graduate education, the concentration of the most liberal in urban hubs where they talk to one another and become more liberal at a faster speed, if you like. Yeah. These things, I think, are... so there's a wide gap, wider and wider gap to exploit between the very liberal and the quite liberal, if you want to put it that way. And I think elements of the Conservative strategy, I'm not going to say all of it because I know that there's probably lots of different schools of thought on the right, but is that there is mileage to be had in finding positions within that growing space between the very liberal and the quite liberal, and trying to exploit them for electoral purposes.
Mm. We've talked quite a bit about the Conservative Party, but I'd like to move on to talking about Labour, because, of course, only a few days ago, we had the 25th anniversary of the 1997 general election victory, Tony Blair becoming Prime Minister for the first time. And it's an issue that we've talked about quite a bit before. But in light of the essay and in light of the example that you use in terms of the distinction between a direct reasoner and a systemic reasoner, the example of crime, tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime, where do you think Tony Blair fits in terms of the differences between a direct reasoner and a systemic reasoner? Or do you think that he, as he does in quite a lot of other things politically, fits somewhere in the middle in terms of utilising elements of both in terms of rhetoric, particularly thinking back to 97?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. And I think Tony Blair's approach was actually very one of the most interesting things in his book, A Journey, which I quote in the essay, is when he was looking for a head of communications and he's looking at several options, but he settles upon Alastair Campbell because he says, I really wanted a tabloid person. It needs to be a tabloid person. And I think that gets to the sometimes misunderstood element of Tony Blair's appeal, certainly at that point, which was that he was actually pretty good at this direct reasoning, quite comfortable with saying stuff that was very much that kind of A plus B equals C logic, and saw his role as to reconnect Labour with deprived and working class seats who didn't feel able to vote for the party during the 1980s. He's often seen as the person who made Labour more middle class, which he arguably did. Mm. But he, a big part of it was that he was quite comfortable with that tabloid rhetoric and was not a pundit. And he's now seen as a sort of international globe-trotting person who is detached from that. But certainly I think his pitch was absolutely... I mean, as you say, tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime is a kind of almost too perfect fusion of direct and systemic thinking. And it was about saying both are welcome within the Labour tent. I think he, certainly in the 90s and 2000s, would have been considered himself to be reconnecting Labour with that desire to not overthink things, to not always be looking for root causes, to say sometimes it really is as simple as this. Certainly a lot of the positions he took on national security, nuclear deterrent, things like this, very much aligned with direct reasoning, if you like.
In terms of looking to the future, you mentioned that COVID should be seen by Keir Starmer and the Labour Party as equivalent to the aftermath of the Second World War, in terms of a moment when it's clear that things have continually failed with elements of the British state and elements of the British system, and things need to be reformed and need to be changed. How do you think that that would be best articulated in terms of either making a clear slogan or making a clear point that you think people would be able to connect with? Because I think it's quite interesting when you look at certain elements of direct speaking and direct logic, quite often, though, as you said, it doesn't always mean short and snappy sentences. Quite often it does mean short and snappy sentences, which can be used really rather effectively as slogans and can be used as a sort of like talking point. How do you think he would be able to get that message down into a few words or into a general slogan that people would be able to understand and be able to use and convince other people to vote for Labour?
The point I make in the essay is that there is now a time, I think, a period to rebuild. The parallels with the Second World War and with the desire to rebuild after that have been made before. And I'm not going to stick my head above the parapet and suggest a sort of three-word take back control type slogan that's going to make that happen. And I do think we should bear in mind that systemic arguments are generally harder to make than direct arguments, which is one of the reasons, and in my view, an understated reason, why life is generally harder for progressives than for conservatives, is because saying, let's take a step back, let's look at the wider factors that have led this person to commit this crime, or which have led this person to seek asylum, are harder to make and often more complicated than the more simple, straightforward arguments put forward in a very direct way sometimes. So I wouldn't say that there's a perfect sound, a systemic soundbite that can match the perfectness of the kind of direct soundbite fights favoured by the likes of Dominic Cummings. But I do think that there's three strategies. The first, which I think Keir Starmer has very much been doing, is to be really confident with using direct language, with talking in with focusing on issues like crime, where they're really simple bread and butter issues, and where people need to regain confidence that Labour is basically able to call a spade when it matters, is able to say, we're going to prioritise national security on this thing, we're going to deal with this issue that we see in front of us before we start to think about the wider systemic problems that have caused it. So I think the first thing is that Labour has to be really clear about that it's comfortable using direct thinking and logic when it matters, and that it doesn't see direct thinking as always in opposition to systemic thinking. You know, you can make a systemic argument about the need to borrow more to invest in the economy whilst accepting that there is a, no matter how Keynesian an argument you make, there is a bottom line that the money will run out at some point, and you can kind of, those two things aren't necessarily at odds with one another. Similarly, you can support a much more liberal penal system, prison system, policing, which looks at the wider societal factors, looks at rehabilitation, whilst understanding there are direct arguments for public safety, which at certain moments you have to be, you have to take very seriously. So I think that first thing of appreciating the value of direct systemic, of direct thinking, Keir Starmer's done very well. I think the second thing that progressives need to do is to distance themselves from a small subset of progressive groups and organisations who make systemic and structural arguments more complicated rather than less by saying everything's linked, the system's designed to exploit these problems are baked into our system. Social justice is climate justice. Lots of these kind of things which make things more complicated rather than less. I think progressives need to see it as their role to demystify systemic thinking and say, okay, well, why is it that deprivation leads to crime? Here's the reason why there is a set of tendencies, and here's how we're going to join those dots. And I think the third thing is Labour, once it's taken those first two steps, wins the space to make the argument for big systemic and structural reforms of the kind that happened in 1945, you know, the production, the creation of new institutions, tangible changes to the state, which create a new safety net that people can rely on, a new opportunity that people can take advantage of, which really explain why we're doing those things. Mm-hmm. So those are the three points, I think, really. Acknowledge the value of direct reasoning, dismiss the more confusing elements of progressive systemic thinking, and then make radical arguments about how you fix the system.
Absolutely. Well, thank you once again for coming on the podcast, Chris. I have, however, one final question, which is not entirely related to the essay. But obviously, recently we've had Easter and Easter bank holidays and people eating Easter eggs. There might even still be some people who are still eating their Easter eggs now. But my final question to you is this. If you had to receive an Easter egg that was representative of or fashioned after any political figure, alive or dead, who would you pick to receive an Easter egg of?
So an Easter egg sculpted in the physical image, yes, of a politician. You know what? I'm going to play it unbelievably safe and go for a Clement Attlee shaped Easter egg, which would be, I would unwrap with joy as it arrived on Easter Sunday.
I think that's a great response, Chris, and I think many people would equally be happy to receive a Clement Attlee Easter egg. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast. If people want to read the essay, where should they go to read it?
It's there's three ways you can read it, actually. So it's on the Progressive Britain website under a page called Thinking in Straight Line, so you can read it as a report format there. It's on a Medium blog, so you can read it as a long read there just by googling Medium Thinking in Straight Lines. And it's also an Amazon ebook, which you can buy for £1 if you'd like to read it on a Kindle e-reader.
Excellent. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast.
Pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, @DebatedPodcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast, or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.